So this morning, we'll be talking about the ceremony in Japanese called Techumyaku, or as we've translated in the lay liturgy, the ceremony of following where the precepts, as the blood of the Buddhas, lead. Now, one of the themes that I've been exploring in these talks is the theme of how we bring our humanity to the precepts, how we accept our humanity within the precepts, and how our practice of, say, the ideal of perceptual behavior fits with our humanity and the humanity of the Sangha, really. I talked last time about how each one of us is within this, in this training where we're going from being completely immersed in, or more or less completely immersed in, acting out greed, hate, and delusion to the point of nirvana, which the Buddha defined as the complete eradication of acting out greed, hate, and delusion. And that even our teachers are still within that continuum of training, are still within that continuum of working on letting go of those things. Now, one of the things that is important to remember about the Buddha Dharma is that is something that the Buddha said, which is that the purpose of the Buddha Dharma is to find what he called unshakable liberation of mind. He said at one point, the purpose of the Dharma is not to practice the highest form of morality. It is not to gain spiritual powers. It is not to gain worldly profit or a large following of people. It is merely to find unshakable liberation of mind. In other words, in order to discover what the Buddha discovered, the enlightenment that the Buddha discovered, we don't have to be perfect in an external situation sense. This is a difficult, for myself personally, this is a difficult point to train with, because there's part of me that really does not want to cause suffering for other beings or for myself. And in a sense, by being alive, by having an by being embodied in a human form, it is inevitable that I will create suffering for other beings and for myself. So there's a koan there. How do I kind of deal with that? How do I accept it? I have not found a way to become perfect in the sense of being able to practice the highest form of morality and all those other kinds of things. And I have never encountered anyone who was able to be perfect in that way. So here I am, and it doesn't come up all that often, but it does come up. How do I accept this place? How do I accept being in this place where inevitably I'm going to create suffering? So, in a sense, we're searching for unshakable liberation of mind. And as we go along, we come to a place where we step beyond that koan, that problem. If I act this way in this situation, I'm going to create suffering. If I act this way in this situation, the other way in this situation, I'm going to create suffering. At various times in our training, we actually learn how to step beyond that place or step beneath it. We go to a deeper place and we recognize what the real issue is. Because a lot of times we don't really see clearly what we're being asked. We don't really see clearly what the real issue is. So if I find myself in that situation, I think to myself, well, what what's the real thing, real question? What's the real question? And then just be willing to sit still in that place. And something shifts, something arises, something changes. And I'm able to step beyond that. And in a sense, realize that the question that was confronting me is a side issue for going forward. And in a way, so this is a very liberating ability to have. This is a very liberating place to find yourself. And you can conclude, if you find yourself there, that you have, in a sense, gone beyond karmic consequence. But that would be a mistake. We always need to be able to make a decision on the level of our human life where we live and accept the consequences for it. So I was looking at some problem this morning and realizing I can't make a decision between either of these two things as I see it now. And ask myself, well, what's the real question here? And realize there was a question about separation involved, which is slightly different than what was actually there. And once I recognized, oh, that's a mistaken perception, then I can go back to my original problem and make a decision based on a deeper knowledge of the situation. I will still have to choose one or the other of those things. And there may still be suffering involved by choosing one. But choosing from a place where I see a deeper aspect of the thing makes all the difference in terms of going forward and in terms of accepting the consequences. There is never a time in our practice, in our life, where karma consequence does not apply to us. There never will be a time when karma consequence does not apply to us. It behooves us all, I will say, without trying to force anything on anybody, to really deeply look at that situation and accept it. No matter how free or liberated we may be or feel, there will always, karma consequence always applies. It is that by stepping into a place of liberation, we begin to be able to accept that deeply and be at peace with it. Our ceremony today, that we're talking about today, is going to be the ceremony in which we receive what's called the bloodline of the Buddhist ancestors, the bloodline certificate. I've brought mine today, the one that I received as a layperson when I first took the precepts some time ago. It's folded up in this nicely Japanese-y envelope. On the outside, it has a calligraphy that says the true precepts of the Bodhisattvas on it. And the Chinese character for emptiness, or mu. And it is, I don't know whether it's, it goes like that. And the ideogram is actually of a house on fire. It's burning up. And that is symbolic of the nature of impermanence, the nature of emptiness, the nature of mu. There's a constant, this impermanence goes right to the heart of shunyata, of emptiness. Okay. So that's the Japanese or the Chinese character on our bloodline certificate envelope. On the other side, it says the name of the priest who gave me the precepts and my name, and then it's sealed with a three treasure seal, the red stamp. It turns out, and this again goes to what I'm talking about accepting the humanity of ourselves and of our teachers. It turns out that the priest who gave me the precepts is no longer a monk in our tradition. He's gone off and is doing other things now. In other words, he is a human being. Okay. I learned a lot from him. And he truly gave me the precepts. He was the person who stood in there and said, I'm going to be a human being and I'm going to do the best that I can and I'm going to give you the precepts. And this means you can train yourself. You can practice yourself. You can find the truth of the Buddha yourself. And so, in a way, it's deeply significant to me. And I have to look carefully at his actions and see what about him I would not copy, what about him I would not do, and learn from that, learn as it's teaching me to more deeply practice the precepts, but also to more deeply accept the humanity of those with whom I train. So that's the envelope for our Ketchumyaku, our bloodline certificate. And here is the bloodline certificate itself. It's all folded up neatly. The Japanese really like to fold paper, so it's and here's the graph of the bloodline certificate. So those of you who have taken the precepts have seen it before. Thought I'd show it to you. Now, what's on the graph is maybe kind of prosaically first, a list of all of the Buddhas and ancestors down from the time of from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha to me. My name is written in down there on that list as a layperson. William Marlowe Catton, there I am. So there's a list, and it's the same list that we chant every morning, the ancestral line. And that ancestral line means one human being was willing to stand up and say, I'm going to do the best that I can, practice the Dharma, to practice the precepts, and pass on what I've learned to another human being. It's a living tradition. Okay. And it's funny because there's scholars who'll read things in scholarly literature about, say, Bodhidharma. They question whether Bodhidharma actually existed. And maybe it's true. Maybe Bodhidharma didn't really exist as Bodhidharma, the person that's there. But somebody, at the time of Bodhidharma, a human being was willing to pass on the practice of the Dharma to another human being in the next generation. Somebody, whether these names apply to real people or not, real individuals who you can historically trace down or not, they still represent a reality, which is that one human being practiced the Dharma, did the best that they could, and passed that on to another human being. So that's what this represents, this list. Now, going through the list, there's a red line. The red line starts at the top of the page with an empty circle in red. And that empty circle, in Zen, and particularly in Zen, an empty circle almost always symbolizes the unborn, the emptiness, shunyata, cosmic Buddha, the formless Buddha. So the red line starts at that empty circle at the top of the page, and then goes down through the name of Shakyamuni Buddha, says Shakyamuni Buddha, great priest, and then winds around to Makakasho, and there's three columns here on the page. So it goes from Shakyamuni Buddha to Makakasho, and then circles around back to Ananda, and on down through the ancestral line. And there's a kind of squiggly line that goes through all of the precepts, all of the different human beings on this list. Squiggly line. Comes back up, goes back down, comes back up, goes back down. Finally comes to me at the end. William Marlowe Catman, new ancestor. Through the priest who gave me the precepts. then for me, so I'm on that bloodline with all of the Buddhas and ancestors. When you take the precepts, you're on that bloodline with all of the Buddhas and ancestors. Then for me, the line comes back up and goes directly back to the unborn. So this is deeply important. We have a connection to the unborn through the tradition, through those who have practiced in our before us, who have handed down the practice, but we also have a direct connection to the eternal, to the Buddha, to the unborn Buddha, right within ourselves, right within our bodies and minds. And this red line represents the precepts, the practice of the precepts, the life of the precepts. Over the top of at different places on this graph, there are more three treasure seals placed, and they sort of affirm that the three treasures were present then. Over Shakyamuni Buddha, over Dogen, and my name, and over the text here. This seal, this three treasure seal, just as sort of historical interest, it's a kind of squiggly line that looks like a bit like a maze in a circle, and you can't really. It doesn't really, to my mind, look like there's any specific thing about it. I've been told that the seal was created during a time of Chinese history when Buddhism was being persecuted, and Buddhist teachers wanted to have a way of sort of sealing. Affirming, committing to the Dharma, saying that the Dharma is present here, without making an overt statement of that, sort of secret seal. So it's the three treasures, the characters, the Chinese characters for the three treasures are embedded somewhere in these seals, but they're done in a kind of code. So there have been times in history when Buddhism was not really allowed to be practiced in various places, but still. And that's one of the things that's represented through here. Still, those human beings thought, this is important enough for me to continue to practice in secret and to pass on to others. Now, there's an idea in Buddhism called the Buddha Mind Seal. And this is something that you as you go along, you become kind of aware of or sensitive to. It is the seal of someone who is practicing meditation and the precepts. And it appears in people. It appears in a strange kind of way. People, not strange, but it's sort of like, I met somebody once, actually came to work for me in a bakery that I was working in. And I just had the feeling, this person has been practicing meditation before. And as it turns out, yeah, he'd been practicing meditation in the sort of similar tradition for me, and he didn't do it much anymore. His wife was more active in it, but he had actually practiced meditation and taken it seriously. You begin to be able to see that. And what I want to get at here is that the practice of meditation, the keeping of the precepts, it awakens and moves a life within us. And that life is this bloodline. That blood, that kind of life, that kind of pumping of the energy, the water of the spirit, that is something that can be seen in the world and recognized by people who know it, by people who have experienced it and who are practicing it. So there's a life here that we knowingly or unknowingly pass on. There's a nice thing I wanted to remind us of from Dogen's Genjo poem. I really like the story that's in here, but I realize that the whole paragraph says something quite important. So this is the last paragraph of the Genjo Koan. It is wrong to believe that one is fully aware of being enlightened as personal knowledge, even after enlightenment. That's a really important point. Goes to that point that Burmester Jiu makes where she says, we can never know when we are meditating. We can always know when we're not meditating. Okay. That which is intuitive cannot necessarily be given easy expression in definite form, even though enlightenment is already ours. There's a line in the ordination ceremony where it says, now that you have taken the precepts, you have attained to the rank of the Buddha. You are now a baby Buddha. It is by, again, planting this tree, the seedling of our spiritual aspiration in the mandala of the Buddha, in the realm of the Buddha, by making the commitment to keeping the precepts, that we actually become Buddhas. We give expression to enlightenment. We may not know that, we may not realize it, but we are giving expression to enlightenment. One summer day, a Zen teacher sat fanning himself when a monk asked, "Since the nature of wind is stationary and universally present, why do you use a fan?" So in other words, he's getting at this question, since it is taught that you are already enlightened and you know that, why do you need to train yourself? Why do you need to continue to go forward, to look more deeply, to train yourself? The teacher replied, "Although you know its nature to be stationary, you do not know why it is universally present." Oh, that's interesting. So the monk says, why is it universally present? And for an answer, the teacher merely continued fanning himself. And the monk bowed. The true way of transmission and enlightenment, which is the result of real experience, is the same as this. In other words, again, we come back to this idea of Dogens. It is by practicing the precepts, by practicing meditation, by putting the teaching into practice in our life, by continuing to go forward, that we are giving expression to enlightenment. It is the nature of enlightenment to do these things. And in that sense, a bit back to what I was originally talking about, we come to the point where we say, if I do X, I'm going to break the precepts. If I do Y, I'm going to break the precepts. What do I do? And you might, and so then we sit still in that place and we see how to step beyond that place. Stepping beyond, you might think, I'm now going to set aside the precepts. But that would be a mistake. It is by continuing to make the inquiry, by continuing to bring ourselves to that point, either this or that, step beyond it, that we give expression to enlightenment and that we deepen our enlightenment. When we step beyond it, we can still keep the precepts. We can still give expression to the precepts. It's just different than we expected it to be. What we're really letting go of, what we're really setting aside, is our own view of things. Our own mind, our own way of thinking about things, which creates our suffering. We can set that aside, we can let go of it, we can look more deeply. In a way, it's not that we've changed ourselves, it's just that we've let go of something. We've ceased to insist upon things. One who thinks that fanning is not needed simply because wind is stationary by nature and requires no fan, since it can be sensed, understands nothing whatsoever of its nature and its eternal presence. It is because it is eternally here that the wind of Buddhism makes the earth golden and the rivers run with ki. So for this ceremony then, we we receive this bloodline certificate. And the way the ceremony goes is that it used to be, when I did the ceremony, I took the precepts in Oregon. When did I take the precepts? Look at the date here. Oh, yeah, okay. June 8, 1985. When I took the precepts in Oregon, I took the precepts in Oregon at a retreat and then went to the Abbey later the next year for Jikai, just to go there and do that. So when I was there for Jikai, the way that this ceremony works is that we were all, again, participating in our cleansing of karma retreat. We were doing working meditation or whatever we were doing. And on the day the ceremony was going to happen, we were told, okay, we don't really know when this ceremony is going to happen. Just pay attention, and when you see a procession forming up, follow along in the procession. So it was out, at the time, it was there were a lot of digging projects going on. So I think I was either moving rocks in wheelbarrows or digging rocks out of the ground and putting them into wheelbarrows, something like that. And so we were just working along, and we hear, somebody says something like, oh, there's the procession number. Master Jiyu is walking along. She's dressed in her formal robes and has one of those classic kind of conical Japanese hats on. You can't really see her face. She's walking along with her monk staff in an alms bowl, and her chaplain's following behind her. And we all put down what we're doing and go and follow along in the procession. And the procession winds around and goes, as I say, there's like 16 acres at the Abbey, and the procession winds all over the property. It winds through the cloister, where there's a nice sidewalk. It winds up through the central garden, where there are some nicer dirt paths. It winds around through where the compost bin is, and all around. And it doesn't go in a particularly straight line. And then finally, it winds into this Buddha hall, and around and around and around. We take our seats. When we practice the precepts, it will change the direction of our life. It will change it, and in a sense, they will be leading us along. We will get to a point where we realize, oh, if I've committed myself to the precepts, and if I'm going to do that, if I'm going to follow through on that, I'm going to have to make a decision here that's going to lead me in a direction where I had not planned to go, or which surprises me in some way and will change the direction of my life. What was I watching television the other night? This happens to people. I mean, this is just the nature of deciding to act with integrity in the world, and is really no different for us than anybody else. It's simply formalized for us. And I was watching TV the other night, and there was a person who was a superintendent of, it's a fictional show, superintendent of police in Chicago, and her brother decided that he would try to get her to fix a situation. He accepted a bribe from someone and tried to get her to fix the situation so that he could, kind of get more money from this person. Mm-hmm. And she basically had to say, her brother-in-law, she basically had to say, sorry, I can't do that. I can't take a bribe. I can't be party to this. You have to turn yourself into the FBI. Or I will. And it basically meant that she, by doing that, she became alienated to her niece and nephew and her sister and her family, because she didn't back down. It's fiction, I suppose. But there it is. That's the reality of life. We make this commitment and we allow it to influence us for good or ill. And again, that changes our life, and that represents that kind of twisting and turning. Some of the times we encounter things that are unpleasant, some of the things that we encounter are pleasant. Always, though, we're going more deeply into what can happen. And again, I want to emphasize that our path is the path of following our own heart. It is the path, again, of following the mind that seeks the way, which arises within. Our path is going more deeply into our own life, into the life within us. So then you get into the ceremony hall, and the monk who's doing the, who's the abbot of the temple, will show you their version of, or they will show you one of the monks' versions of this Kechenyaku. Because at each stage of our deepening commitment to the Dharma, we receive this same basic document. Okay. So for my transmission as a monk, the ceremony of transmission as a monk, I have this, and it's written out on a much longer piece of silk. And there's some slight variation to what's going on here because it includes part of Dogen's. Dogen has double lineage in a sense from a Rinzai priest and from a Soto priest. But it is the same basic document. Okay, written on silks. Interestingly enough for me, the priest who signed my silks, the priest who gave me the precepts in my transmission, is also no longer a monk, no longer practices in our tradition. We always come back to this place where we need to be able to accept our humanity and the humanity of those around us. And our ability to do that is profound. Our ability to accept the humanity of those around us is profound. It goes right to the heart of this empty circle. We can live at peace within our own hearts, with our own humanity, which may be, like I say, when I look at my own mind, I just think, God, how can you be such an idiot? And yet, there is this thing, there is Buddha nature, and we can be at peace in deeply insane circumstances. Not that I've experienced that many deeply insane circumstances. We can accept the humanity of others, even if that represents deep suffering. So, I think that that's all that I have to say about that. Are there any questions? Oh, wait, I'm sorry. During all of this, as I said last week, we were chanting the mantra of great wisdom, you know, gyate, gyate, para gyate, para so gyate, bodhisattva. Going on beyond. And always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. Yeah. And again, it's pointing in this direction. We might think our life has to do with the externals, where we're going, what we see, but the going on beyond is always just going more deeply in within. And whether we go fast or slow, there's just this steady going on. Doesn't matter whether we go fast or slow. Doesn't matter at all. We just take the next step and go as we can. Just keep going on beyond. That's all. Okay, that's what that's. Yes?
I was having a conversation with someone who had been a Christian person, and then as a teenager just, I guess, decided it wasn't real, decided that that one's role in the universe was so small that it doesn't matter anything you do, you're gonna die and it doesn't matter, and we're just little specks of squishy stuff on the crust of a ball of burning rocks, and it just doesn't matter. And we were talking about this ceremony of taking the precepts that's coming up for me, and it also kind of came up, like, to do something like this after having, I've had a similar experience of just, how could it possibly matter what I do? It couldn't matter. This is just, I'm just so insignificant. And I guess it's sort of this tension between having a really inflated view of my importance in the world or a really, really opposite view where I have zero importance whatsoever and I can't affect anything. But anyway, so for me to take the precepts is deciding to revisit the question of, does anything I do matter? And in a way, it's like, I don't mean this to be flippant, but on some level, it could seem like an extra hassle to add of, like, I decided this doesn't matter, and I wasn't going to think about it anymore. But here I am, and it seems good to not only think about it, but commit to a certain point of view about it. But I guess through the conversation, I just was remembering the way I used to think about these things, and also I didn't quite know how to express that it... I guess what you were saying about it just comes back to being willing to just be human and to grapple with things.
The it is in Lotus Blossom, Urban Master Jiyu gives expression to the teaching, nothing matters. And largely it's true. Nothing matters. And yet in that place there is still this life within us, which comes back to the question, well, what shouldn't I be doing this? Shouldn't I look into this? There is something in us which, although you could say doesn't matter, there's still life within us. There's still this seeking mind within us. And in a way, to ignore that thing, to ignore that impulse to look more deeply into this, into this question, is in a sense to cut off part of our own life, which for me, I have this kind of visceral, I feel like that would be bad, if you know what I mean. And so here's this interesting conundrum. Because part of us, some life in us, wants to look more deeply into this thing. And yet, on an intellectual level, we can see, and some of the great teachers are telling us, nothing matters. So, to me, this is a question for more deep inquiry, for more deep reflection within myself. This is a situation that wants that, requires it. And then from there I'm thinking, well, how do I do that? And so then I find meditation and the precepts, and the Buddha is saying, well, if you have that kind of mind, actually Tezong puts it nicely, if you're the sort of person who seeks the way, you will be the person who finds the way. And in a way the Buddha is kind of saying the same thing. Well, you know, I'm not going to go out and try to convert people. But if people want to come to me and they have this kind of question arising in their mind, I can point them in the right direction. I can point them in a direction that will be helpful. And so, in a sense, we are, and this is quite important for me, in a sense, we are stepping outside of our intellectual understanding of how the world works and following a deeper impulse within us. And that's what I'm talking about coming to a point where you realize I can't make this decision and I can't make that decision. Because that decision, you know, deciding that nothing matters and I'm just going to go out and be a nihilist and do whatever I want, well, that didn't work. Because I feel like, whatever. But on the other hand, if I hold on too tightly to this, if I hold on and I insist too much on this morality view, then, well, that doesn't work either, because I bind myself into a knot and can't live. So if I choose this, I'm suffering. If I choose that, I'm suffering. What do I do? Sit still within it. What's the deeper question? The deeper question is, well, there's this impulse within me to look deeply into life, to look deeply into the nature of suffering, into the nature of what effect I actually do have on my life. And so, okay, I'll follow that impulse. And you, in a sense, step beyond that question. Because there's that deeper thing within us. We don't even know what that deeper thing is or whatever. It's just some part of our life that we can't really ignore, or we'd be killing something within us. So we just follow that thing and trust that. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, I guess it doesn't, you know, it doesn't offer a reason for being or a meaning of it all or anything like that. It's just eliminating or reducing the amount of suffering.
The Buddha didn't get into philosophy, or not a lot anyway, or these existential reasons. What he talked about was doing something about our suffering. And yeah, on one level, nothing we do matters. And on another level, when you cause suffering for yourself and others, that doesn't feel good. And what the Buddha offered, what the path that Reverend Leon has been talking about all morning offers, is a way for us to do something about it. And the Buddha completely left it up to us. Well, you know, fine. If you want to go on and believe that nothing matters, be my guest. And there is truth in that, but it's an intellectual truth for most of us. What Reverend Master realized, she realized it on a visceral level, and you will see what's interesting is that she got up the next day and trained. So it wasn't like nothing matters and so to hell with everything. It was nothing matters, I'm completely freed from my fear. I'm freed from my judgmentalism. I'm freed from my hatred and I won't say completely, but anyway, she discovered a much greater, deeper freedom at that particular time through that. And that's what that nothing matters is pointing at. And when we use it to grow our despair, we're misunderstanding it. And that's unfortunately, a lot of training can be misused in a lot of ways. The precepts can be used as a straitjacket, misused as a straitjacket. That's a misuse. Meditation can be used as this, you know, peace where I can do what I damn well please. That's a misuse. And nothing matters can be misused as to go, you know, allow you to get up to whatever you please or to, you know, wallow in despair. And that's a misuse. And there's a truth there. And when we recognize that what we do has an effect on ourselves and others, and that effect can cause suffering for ourselves and others if we're not following the precepts, there opens a potential purpose. And it's up to us whether we want to follow that or not.
One of the logical extensions of the law of karma, and is something I've proven true for myself, or at least on some level, is that rebirth happens, and that while nothing matters, we're just a bug on the surface of a molten rock. We're going to continue to be a bug on a surface of a molten rock.
If we don't,
for some time to come, and we have been continuing to do that for some time to come, and so on a kind of practical level, it becomes, well, you know, how can it doesn't? I can commit suicide. Okay, well, great. It's like the movie Groundhog Day. I can commit suicide. I can find all kinds of different ways to commit suicide. But still, I'm going to come back to this same day again. I'm still going to be here in this place where nothing matters and everything I do matters. How do I deal with that conundrum? And the Buddha is offering us a way, saying, well, start meditating, keep the precepts, make a commitment, go for it.
And that's what Buddhism is. When you decide you've had enough, here.
It's always here,
yeah,
if we want it.
It's always here if we want it. That's what, it's just the most amazing gift. And it's up to us.
And I've been thinking about taking the precepts and I have also thought, well, on many aspects, I feel like I want to go for that. That I see, you know, it makes sense. It's meaningful. It's like I really want to be there. And knowing that, like, deep inside, it's already there. It's like there's no going like outwards, but more like going inwards, but also being there. Like, I can't explain. But on the other hand, it's like, it's kind of limiting, and it's kind like I'm putting a label on myself, and then this is the only way to go, and I'm not going to be able to look at the other things. And that's also very interesting, and I also feel attracted to that and to that. But I need to just, you know, see this way.
There's a... Did you answer it?
No, please, you just go. Jump right in there.
I think that there's an image that comes to mind. We want to keep our options open. you know, it's like if you fall in love with somebody and you really like them, and you think, well, you know, I ought to get married, but I want to keep my options open.
Yeah.
There and over there and up like that. And yet people do make a commitment to a relationship, and that changes the relationship and deepens it. It allows it to take on a different meaning, and it allows it to new things to happen within that relationship, and it allows it to expand and grow. It's a bit like taking a tree and deciding that I don't really want to commit my tree to a piece of ground, so I'm going to grow it in a pot, which works pretty good if your tree is a dwarf lemon and you you know, need to move it in and out and all that stuff. But if your tree is an oak or a beech or something that can grow quite large, that tree will never reach its full potential unless you actually take it out and put it in the ground and allow it to do what trees do in the ground. And our spiritual life is the same. When we, and this is what I'm talking about in terms of planting our spiritual tree in the mandala of the Buddha. When we make a commitment to the precepts, we're taking our tree, our spiritual life, our aspiration for enlightenment, and we're saying, I'm going to plant this in the ground of the Buddhas and ancestors. And I'm going to let it deepen and grow there. And that means I am going to be setting aside my interest in those other things over there. But because I've made this commitment, there's this great tree that whenever I'm thinking about this, I think about down in the Congaree National Swamp, whatever it's called, National Park,
yeah.
Congaree National. Yeah, anyway, there's this great tree. This is this huge beech. I mean, the thing must be like 3 or 4 feet in diameter, and you know, maybe like 150 feet high. And that beech reminds me of the Buddha. Lifetime after lifetime, he continues to plant his tree in the soil, and that just continues to grow year after year. That is the potential that we have. Not just in our little pot we can take around and have and be nice. We have this potential to grow something which is profoundly significant, which in spite of the fact that nothing matters deeply.
Reverend Master described it as a mistake in spiritual life not shopping. What's the word she used? I can't think of the
smorgasbord
kind of thing. Each religious tradition has a path, and that path has worked for a broad number of people that have tried that, and to find that working for you, you need to commit yourself to that path. It's like having 8 maps and you want to get to New York or something, and so you follow this map for a little while, and then you say, well, you know, I don't like the look of that street up there, so now I'm going to go over to this map and follow, but where the hell are you? And, you know, then, you know, it gets confusing, and one of the streets goes off that way, you don't know how even to get to the street.
They did that in Top Gear, remember? They were in New York.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but yeah, they followed a map, and then they said, oh, well, we'll do this. They ended up being more lost.
That's what happens when you try various maps, which in a sense the Buddha Dharma is a map, and the map works if you follow it. And I mean, that's what the bloodline of man, that's what he was talking about, all these twists and turns, and you will find yourself in places you don't care for, thank you very much. And what we happen to do as human beings is we often blame it on the Buddha Dharma. Well, it's not the Buddha's Dharma's fault where you started from. The Buddha Dharma simply offers you a map to get to where you want to go if, in fact, you want to do something about your own suffering or dissatisfaction or however you want to translate that word, dukkha. And it really requires a commitment. Or you never get below the surface. That's not quite the word I'm looking for. You never really... It's a little bit like going into a smorgasbord. When we as humans, if we went to that, something like that regularly, most of us would only end up eating the desserts. You know, it really wouldn't give us much nutrition. We've got to be willing to eat the broccoli and the beans and whatever else is there, whether we like it or not. Because that's the way we take care of our body. And the way we take care of ourselves spiritually is to commit to a path and do our best to follow it completely. Now, I'm not saying that there will never come a time when you will find this doesn't work for me. Although, I am saying that in my experience, it does work. But you may come to that point. In which case, fine, if you decide you have to try something else, okay. And if you do that, try it completely, wholeheartedly. If Reverend Master used to say, and I don't have it quite, you know, it was a quote about, do whatever you do wholeheartedly. That's not the...
Martin Luther used to say, if you're going to sin vigorously.
So if you're gonna try this path, do it vigorously, do it wholeheartedly. And then if you discover this just isn't helpful for me, or you know, I have no where I am, I have no Sangha to support me and no teacher around, and this is something that would work for me in this situation, fine. I mean, does that make any sense?
Yes, and I'm also thinking about that. I mean, like, this is I feel very good in this place, and I'm also thinking that I'm not gonna be able to be here after May or June, and where I'm gonna be, I haven't really thought about how things are going to be. I'm just gonna think like, well, I'm kind of gonna be by myself, but it's not. I'm not too worried about that. I've been also thinking that this is a way, but I think it's not like you cannot do things that are not in the book, but also make sense for the way. Do I mean?
No.
It's like I hear not religions, because in a sense I've been looking at religions, and I don't really feel like I want to be in that religion or I want to be in that religion, because I see more of what I'm looking for in this religion. But I hear things from people who are not in this religion that also apply to this religion and that also makes sense for this religion. And it's also related to, it goes directly to what this religion says you should do. And it makes sense for me. And that's my point. I see also a lot of truth in that. And I think, in a sense, it's the same truth without a name.
It doesn't, we don't, by making a commitment to the precepts, you know, in a sense, you're not really, you're not committing to our tradition or to our a teacher here or to anything like that. You're just making a commitment to the precepts and the way that Buddha kind of formulated a path and saying, I want to follow these precepts. The truth appears in all kinds of different forms, and we need to be able to recognize that. And part of the deeper meaning of taking refuge in the Sangha is not just taking refuge in the people that you meet here, but recognizing that other people in the world are practicing truth and bowing to, and in a sense relying on that and taking refuge in that. Part of the practice of meditation is allowing ourselves to be limited by the Dharma, but mainly letting go of our understanding of what the Dharma is and what it ought to be. Letting go of our sense of how we ought to practice the rules, how we ought to be. So there is no, I mean, in a way there is, it is quite possible, we talk about the precepts as a rope, and a Chalanath, if you go past the Chalanath statue, he's holding a rope in his hand and a sword. And the rope represents the precepts. And we, in a sense, bind ourselves to cease from acting on greed and delusion with the precepts. And in that sense, it is constricting. But the practice of the Dharma is liberating in the sense of allowing us to, within that perceptual life, find out how to be a fully relaxed human being and to be able to just function normally and freely in the world.
The other thing about committing yourself to a particular practice is it allows your faith to grow. And in my experience, when you willingly make an offering of yourself to, in our particular tradition, to the eternal or the Buddha nature within, or however you want to describe it, something supports your practice. And wherever you go, you find something supporting your practice. Now, you might not find it in any way you would have expected to. I'm not saying you would necessarily find a teacher, or maybe not right off. It might take, you know, some time, or you might not find a sangha the way you would expect to find a sangha. But something supports your desire to train. And in my experience, what it requires from you is a willingness to make that commitment, to make that offering, that willingness to say, I'm willing. And in that way, something will support it. And I've been amazed. You know, that's what brought me here. I just had a feeling that this was a good thing to do when I left the West Coast. But I didn't know anybody. So I had no idea I was going to end up in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anybody in any of the areas I was thinking of going to. I had no support. I had no anything. But it felt like a good thing to do, to make an offering to others, what my master had offered to me. That's what was coming up in my training. And I was willing to follow that. And I was willing to make that offering. And this is what grew out of it. And I'm grateful that I followed that. And that, in my experience, that's how it works, is that willingness. You know, there's a Zen koan, what do you do, you know, when you're at the top of a 100-foot pole? You know, and part of it is just taking the next step. You don't know where you're going to go. You know, all it looks like is a 100-foot drop. You know, it's scary. And I'm not suggesting, you know, that you leap from a 100-foot pole, literally. I'm talking about being willing to take the next step when there's no obvious right answer, when there's nothing obviously going to support you there. When this story about the woman, you know, her trying to follow the precepts looked like it was going to end up being very uncomfortable, and yet she felt like she needed to follow that. And that's a good story, and that it shows, you know, what we may need to do. And when you keep the precepts like that, something supports you. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
I happen to have a dwarf lemon tree that's a pain in the butt to move around.
It's not as easy as it looks for me.
Would you prefer a big oak tree?
I have those as well.
All right. Anything else? Okay.
Did that answer your question about truth from other places?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That. Mm-hmm. So that addressed that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.